Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, as African Union peacekeepers step up their presence in war-torn Darfur, we hear from two aid agencies providing food, shelter, and above all, hope for more than 2 million people struggling to survive the conflict. And as Pope Benedict calls for increased practical cooperation between Christians and Muslims, one expert on interfaith relations in Africa gives us a realistic assessment of where the dialogue is headed. And Thomas the Twin. Pope Benedict continues his teachings on the apostles at his weekly general audience. Welcome to the programme. It's been called the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Some 200,000 people have already died, and up to 2.5 million more are now on the move, fleeing from murderous raids on their villages. Most of them survive under plastic sheets in cramped and squalid camps, totally dependent on whatever handouts they receive from aid agencies in the region. The conflict in Darfur, a huge arid region in western Sudan, erupted in 2003 when rebel African groups began attacking government targets, and the authorities in Khartoum responded with a brutal crackdown, sending in feared Arab Janjaweed militias to slaughter, rape and burn whole villages.
People who have fled their villages did so, you know, in murderous, horrible conditions, where militias rode into their villages at night, burned, looted, stole, raped.
Simon Crittle is spokesman for the World Food Programme in Sudan. He's just back from a visit to Gereda Camp in Darfur, the world's largest camp for internally displaced people, where conditions, he says, are becoming increasingly desperate.
They're living under plastic tarpaulins. They don't have as much to eat as they would like. They don't have basic things like electricity and clean water. Disease is very, very high in the camps. Things like malaria, cholera, malnutrition are very high. I spoke to one woman who told me that she'd been there for 3 years. She was sitting around. She had nothing to do. In the meantime, some of her children had died of disease. And they really, you know, the hope for these people is really running out. They see very, very little in the way of conflict resolution on the horizon.
And women are reported to be particularly at risk from violence both in and outside the camps. Have you found this too?
Absolutely, absolutely. In Gereda, when I was there, I went to a local hospital and I spoke to some of the patients and I spoke to some of the doctors. The doctor there told me that every couple of days a woman is brought in who is the victim of sexual assault. We've all heard the stories about when women have to leave the camps to collect firewood, how they're very, very vulnerable and they're often attacked. What we're very concerned about at WFP is that if we're not able to reach hundreds of thousands of people as we can't now, that it won't just be women leaving the camps, it will be a lot of people in search of alternative sources of food. And when they do that, when they leave the camps, they're very, very vulnerable to attack. Kofi Annan said that we could be looking at another Rwandan-type situation, so we're extremely concerned about the future of these people.
Earlier this year, as international pressure mounted on the Sudanese government to stop the killing, the African Union mediated a peace deal signed in May this year. But only one rebel faction signed the accord, and aid workers say the violence has actually increased since then. Since the Sudanese government will not allow a United Nations force into the region, African Union peacekeepers this past week extended their mandate until the end of the year and are due to receive financial and logistical support from Western countries. So does this mean things will get better for the millions of internally displaced people or IDPs? Or is there still a real threat that the lack of security means many aid agencies may be forced to pull out of the region?
I think if you'd asked me that question a week or so ago, I would have said there was a very high risk of pullout. and that was before the decision about the continued presence of an AU peace force.
Anne Masterson directs a joint ecumenical aid programme in Darfur run by the Caritas Confederation and by the Global Alliance Action by Churches Together.
I think the biggest problem in Darfur is security, and there is a need to keep a peace force present. And that force has to be, you know, resourced and equipped and have enough soldiers to allow it to be effective. I think in recent weeks, the lack of clarity of whether the AU would continue or not meant the situation deteriorated a lot. And we had increased banditry on the roads, we had attacks on our vehicles, we had robberies, we had staff beaten up. Even in one or two of the IDP camps, we were unable to go into work because of the IDP's anger at the peace process, the DPA, which is the peace agreement. So we did have a lot of incidences in the last few months. I think the decision just under a week ago to allow the AU to continue at least till December has helped the situation. It obviously hasn't resolved it because we still have a lot of clarity as to what this force will represent, what will its resources be. And again, we will face a similar problem in December. So I think the main issue underpinning any insecurity here is the lack of an effective peace force. Whether that's AU or UN is another question.
But with the larger and better equipped AU force, are you hopeful the situation can actually improve, that things can get better for people on the ground there?
I think it can improve in that we will be able to get access to people and so provide assistance where and when necessary. But I don't think that will solve the whole problem. I think the peace process and the political process to promote a peace, an acceptable peace, is essential to continue. The peace agreement that was signed, as many know, a large group of the population, particularly the IDPs, do not support it and feel that it doesn't represent their views and opinions. I think there needs to be an openness to open up the dialogue to those groups who did not sign so that we get a broader discussion. A more open, you know, discussion on a peace process and a future for many of these people. So unless that is going on parallel, and obviously that's not the role of us as this agency on the ground, but that needs to happen at other levels.
Now, this has been called the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Can you just tell us a little bit about the situation there on the ground? How serious and how difficult life is for the people, particularly the IDPs in these camps?
I mean, the IDPs, many of them will have been there since 2004. These camps are very restricted. They're not allowed, they're very much on a temporary basis, so they're not allowed to produce, they don't have land to produce their own food. They don't have access to income, so they're very much reliant on aid, food and resources. So especially we've just now towards the end of a very long rain season, and so of course these people are living under plastic sheeting in these conditions. I think the other more serious issue many is their own security. None of them feel secure enough to go back to their homes. Even though some of them may be from areas very close to the IDP camps, they cannot go back even to farm their lands. So I think besides the millions who have been displaced already, we're seeing others, new displacements. We're also seeing IDP camps where people are feeling insecure and are breaking up and are moving to other locations. And we are seeing some IDP camps which have around them are hostile forces around them who attack them when they go for firewood, attack them when they're outside. So it's a very insecure environment, and it's also an environment that is not allowed to be any way improved because it's required by the authorities here that the camps are temporary.
You're talking about the lack of security for people, and women are particularly at risk, particularly vulnerable in this situation, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, Darfur is not yet another example of using violence towards women as a weapon. And we have seen cases of this. And obviously, we have many women who have been traumatized by this. They are particularly vulnerable as they go for water and firewood. And in fact, patrols have been set up in the past to protect them with AU forces to move with them. This is happening effectively in some areas, maybe not as effectively in other areas because of the lack of numbers of forces on the ground, but also that the AU has had a difficult period recently and its acceptance by the IDPs has decreased.
These are long-term issues for people there, aren't they? Even if a peace solution is found, these are problems that are going to go on for a long time into the future. Are you trying to address, as you say, the camps are temporary structures, but are you trying to address some of the longer-term issues for these people?
We are obviously trying, when we work also with host communities, we are trying to also help them, because obviously it's not just the IDPs who are poor, there are people around. Darfur was a very disadvantaged area. So we are trying also to build up structures in some of the host communities so that when the IDPs return, they have something to return to. We also would hope that if a process of more security could be attained, then we could also, as within the Caritas network or maybe through individual members, to assist them to return home and to rebuild their lives. But this is difficult for the IDPs in the current situation, which is so unclear. But obviously, that is the future. The future is that if we can have a stable and peaceful environment to allow them to go home and to rebuild, and there will be huge needs to help them to do that, because many of their villages have been destroyed, and that's originally why they were displaced. They were burnt out of their villages, and of course the land has not been utilized for some years, so there will be much work to do to reestablish, you know, their livelihood and their security when they go back.
Although there's a lot of international attention to this crisis, the conflict first broke out back in 2003, and yet it seems hard to see any kind of imminent solution on the horizon. It must be very difficult to keep hope up in this kind of situation.
I think it is, but on the other hand, when you live here day to day, you know, even though, you know, we have faced difficulties in the last month, particularly attack on vehicles and difficulties for staff, you still see that the team of people working here, and particularly the Sudanese and our national partners who we work with, are all very committed to continuing to assist people. And I think when you see that in the national population and your staff here, that encourages you to know that there has to be a solution. You know, you can't give up on these situations. You just have to hope that with enough effort from both, you know, not just ourselves here on the ground, but by those who have responsibility to make sure that peace is established, that efforts will be made. And I think you never give up when you see the commitment of the people around you to assisting their own people. And also the strength and the strength of the Darfur people, and particularly the IDPs, in living their lives in these very restricted environments, but from continuing, you know, we have worked with women who have lost their husbands, who have lost their children, and yet are still struggling day to day to keep the remainder of the family together, who also are encouraging their children to attend the schools that we try to operate in IDP camps with other NGOs to get their children educated in the hope that there will be a future and a change.
And finally, what can ordinary people here in the West do really to support the vital work that you're doing out there in Darfur?
I mean, I must say, we in this particular unique network of actors, we have received a lot of support from people, and we continue to, and we must, you know, that we must be very thankful to the population here for. But obviously, we need this to continue. As you said earlier, this situation is not going to be resolved in a month or 2 months. It's certainly a longer-term issue. And we need that continued commitment to allow us to continue to operate the clinics, to assist with schools, to assist with food and shelter, while this bigger issue is being resolved. And we would ask them to continue to give us that commitment and to continue to support the people of Darfur, because at least if we can be present and continue to assist to some extent, that demonstrates to them that the outside world hasn't forgotten about them, and they're not a forgotten people, and that also that there's a commitment from the West of the world. And I think particularly, as you're aware, Darfur is a predominantly Muslim environment, and in the present world it's important that this is a demonstration of a predominantly Christian humanitarian network supporting its Muslim brothers and sisters. And I think that's also quite an important demonstration.
Anne Masterson heads a joint ecumenical aid program in Darfur run by the Caritas Confederation and by the Global Alliance Action by Churches Together. And earlier you heard Simon Crittle, spokesman for the World Food Programme in Sudan. We'll be right back. the vital importance of promoting practical cooperation between Muslims and Christians has been underlined recently by Pope Benedict XVI, particularly following the misunderstanding over his remarks about Islam at Regensburg University. But just how easy is it to put this idea into practice, both at leadership and grassroots level, in countries where Muslim and Christian communities live and work side by side?
Before we can talk about maybe a very open and very sincere dialogue, we have to build up trust in one another.
Father Michael McCabe is an expert on interreligious dialogue with the Society of African Missions. He lived for many years in Liberia and frequently returns to the African continent, where the order is present in 16 different countries. My colleague Susie Hodges asked Father Michael for his assessment of where the interreligious dialogue between Catholics and Muslims stands at this point in time.
I think it is really time to move on at this stage, and I think the Pope has apologized sufficiently, and he has made it clear also that he has a profound respect for Muslims and that his position is certainly in line with that of Vatican II, which represented a really watershed in the relations of the Catholic Church to the followers of other religions, emphasizing what we have in common, our common beliefs, and our common commitment to the promotion of peace in our world.
Now, the Pope has spared, in fact, no effort to resolve this misunderstanding. His comments on it, his meeting with the Muslim envoys. What more needs to be done now, do you think?
Oh, I think there is a lot more that needs to be done. At different levels, though not all certainly at the level of the Vatican. But the Pope did speak of his constant efforts to build bridges of friendship between peoples of religions. And I think that must continue in different ways, through visits, through respect, through meeting delegates of the different religions, and I think through, as well, listening to them. I think the dialogue really is only beginning. You know, it's we have to get beyond just saying nice things about them. We have to listen to them and respect their understanding of their own religion, getting kind of beyond polemics. And I think at local levels, a lot more can be done, especially in the dialogue of life, working together to overcome poverty, to overcome injustices that exist, and to promote peace and human development. So really, I think a great deal more can be done at different levels, but it's not all up to the Pope, of course.
And what feedback have you got so far from your contacts in Africa on this whole issue?
I think people were rather worried in Africa, and especially in places where there is a strong presence of Muslims, that the reaction might be rather negative. And there are tensions, certainly, in many parts of Africa. So I get a feeling that there is relief now that the Pope has made these efforts to reconcile and to improve the situation, to lessen the tension anyhow, and that hopefully from here relationships maybe will be better and maybe there will be a greater understanding of one another. And that's a hope more than a reality at the moment.
When it comes to the church leadership in Africa, do you think they are sufficiently committed to the concept of interreligious dialogue?
I think that they are committed to it, but it may not be an issue of major priority for many of them because there are so many other issues that are very important. But I certainly would think that the leaders in Africa certainly take their cue from the teachings of Vatican II and are trying to promote certainly a more positive approach to the followers of other religions, working with them where it is possible and cooperating with them, and certainly showing respect in to the followers of other religions. So I think that in general they are following that line. However, I think it needs to go a little bit deeper than that. And that will take time. They have to listen to one another, more and strive to be more open to one another. And the Pope mentioned a kind of reciprocity. And reciprocity, I suppose, means really each side being prepared to listen to the other and respect the right of the other to interpret their own religions and to say what they believe in and how they understand God and humanity and our common future.
We talked about the church leadership and their commitment to interreligious dialogue. Does that very often, though, does that always filter down to the grassroots level? Do you think it's here perhaps more that there are lingering misunderstandings?
Well, I think the mistrust is still there. I think it will take a long time to overcome the centuries, really, of hostility and mistrust that has existed between the followers of different religions. And I think in a particular way between Christians and Muslims. And remember that Vatican II is only 40 years ago. And it was at that time that really the church kind of started to speak in a different way about the followers of other religions, not to emphasize the differences, not to emphasize what they saw wrong in another religion, but to emphasize what we shared in common and expressing a commitment to dialogue. And I think we're only at the beginning of that, and I don't think it has filtered down to grassroots level. There has been a dialogue of life in many places, for example, in Africa, where Christians and Muslims exist side by side. For example, when I was in Liberia, there were many Muslims there, and there was a great respect, I think, between Christians and Muslims. And I think it may be in more recent times, unfortunately, that relationship has disimproved, really, because of worldwide tensions and this feeling now that Muslims have that they are opposed by the Christian world and that it's a clash between them and the Christian West. And it's associated also with Western values, which very often they repudiate or are suspicious about.
You talk about this clash, and of course we hear a lot about this clash of civilizations, particularly in our post 9/11 climate. Do you think, in fact, it's incidents like this that have helped, as you say, so greater suspicion?
Well, I think the suspicion is there in any case, but I think that everything that leaders say can now be interpreted or read in the light of this suspicion, and it becomes so much worse, because even myself, I was utterly surprised by the depth of reaction, the strength of reaction to the Pope's speech, a speech that he gave in a university context. It just shows that really we have to be very sensitive to that context today, and we have a long way to go before we arrive at the stage of a trusting dialogue where we're really open to each other. I think the Pope mentioned in his responses that he wanted a frank and sincere dialogue. I think that that's an ideal and something that we must strive for. But before we can reach that, we have a lot of trust building to do. We have a lot to do to give the others confidence that we are willing to listen to them, that we don't desire to dominate them, that we respect their difference and their right to practice their own religion and their right to their own beliefs. And I think that a lot more has to be done on that kind of confidence-building measures. I think, for example, of Pope John Paul II, the previous pope, entering into a mosque and praying there. Certainly that was a gesture, I think, which will give many, many Muslims confidence that the Catholic Church respected the followers of the Islamic faith. Likewise, too, the event in Assisi, where the followers of many religions prayed together with him. Those gestures do build up confidence and help to build up trust.
And my thanks there to Father Michael McCabe of the Society of African Missions. And finally, at his weekly general audience here in the Vatican on Wednesday, Pope Benedict XVI returned to his catechesis on the apostles, focusing especially on the figure of St. Thomas the Twin. My colleague Catherine Smybert has all the details.
Dear brothers and sisters.
Speaking to tens of thousands of pilgrims gathered in a sunny St. Peter's Square Wednesday morning, Pope Benedict called to mind St. Thomas and the fourth gospel, in which his personality becomes almost clearer to us than that of some of the others of the 12 apostles.
It is most especially in John's gospel that we learn about Thomas. At a dangerous time in our Lord's life, when he decided to visit Lazarus in Bethany, it was Thomas who said, "Let us also go, that we may die with him." He shows us that the most important thing is never to distance oneself from Jesus.
Here, the Pope says, this apostle underlines that the life of a Christian is one spent together with the Lord Jesus at all times, in word and in deed.
At the Last Supper, it is Thomas who says, "Lord, we do not know where you are going, so how can we know the way?" His question leads to the celebrated response, "I am the way, the truth, and the life." Jesus also proclaims his words to us today.
The Holy Father also looked at one of the most recognized passages about Thomas the Apostle and uses it to highlight the way our own doubt can lead us to spiritual growth.
A first episode in Thomas' life is well known to us all, that of the doubting Thomas, who says, "Unless I see in his hands the print of the nails and place my finger in the mark of the nails, I will not believe." Yet, once Jesus appears to him, he utters the most splendid profession of faith in all the New Testament, "My Lord and my God." Let us take heart from the life of Thomas. He comforts us in our uncertainty, and he helps us learn from Jesus the true meaning of mature faith, encouraging us to persevere as disciples of Christ.
Pope Benedict concluded his audience by recalling that today we mark the World Day for Tourism. It's an occasion, said the Holy Father, to celebrate an important social phenomenon in our contemporary world. He said that he prays that tourism might always promote greater dialogue and reciprocal respect between cultures and become an open door for peace and harmonious living. I'm Catherine Smybert. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and all of us here at the English Programme for today. But we'll be back on the air at this same time tomorrow. Don't forget, you can always find our news and feature programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Stay tuned to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.